Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is going to be another installment in theology. I'm really excited for this. I have with me Dr. Austin Freeman. We're going to be talking about his new book, Tolkien Dogmatics, Theology Through Mythology with the Maker of Middle Earth. It's awesome. I'm really stoked to talk about it. We're not going to cover everything because it's huge and we couldn't do all of that. So if you are pumped about this book and the stuff that we're talking about, you need to go grab it. And if you use the link in my description, it'll also support the podcast. So that's my affiliate link. So go ahead and do that. Before we jump in, though, I want to thank everyone who is making this podcast happen. If you've benefited from this podcast, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. That would be huge. You can support for as little as $3 a month, all the way up to $100, I believe. So, man, if you like this, if this gives value, if this provides value to you, not to your life, because other things give your life value. If you like this podcast, please consider supporting it so that I can continue to have internet access and pay for that. That would be awesome. Another way to support it is sharing this podcast with a friend who likes Tolkien. You can like and leave your comments. Maybe Dr. Freeman will come back and see those, so be nice. But yeah, you can be critical, I guess. So there's a lot of ways to support the pod. Please do so if you like this. Without further ado, though, let's bring in Dr. Austin Freeman and talk about Tolkien Dogmatics.
Oh, hello. How are we today?
Yeah. That's so great. Were you already wearing this before?
Oh, I mean, it's what people expect, right?
When yes.
On Tolkien.
That's you right. So I've just recently actually, like, I know you're saying that, but that's true. Like, I've actually come to the belief that I should start dressing like a professor when I give talks and stuff like that, when I present papers or give apologetics talks, because it helps the ambiance. Like, people are expecting that. And if I can help them get in the right state of mind just by dressing a certain way, then let's do that. Yeah, I'm stoked for that.
I lost you there for a second. It's interesting you should say that. I teach at a classical school, and it's a long-standing debate as to why the students need to wear uniforms. And I tell them every time that the way that you dress affects the way that you think. I'm an advocate for that.
That's awesome. I was totally not into that before. And as I'm studying more and more philosophy, I don't know, man, the philosophers are like, whatever, I'm wearing this. And all the theologians that I'm coming from are like, tweed jacket, of course I'm going to do that. So I was at ETS. Yeah. And I was at ETS and like people were kind of giving me were teasing me for wearing like a bow tie and stuff. And I'm like, dude, I'm coming from theology. Like, this is totally normal over there.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. I love that. Well, awesome, man. Can you tell us a little bit about your theological background? Like, where'd you do your PhD at?
Sure. I did my PhD at the very place that you're sitting right now, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School.
Yeah, let's go. I'm actually not there anymore, but I'm very close by in an undisclosed location.
So the locale. So we were there for 4 years. I did my PhD in systematic theology under the great, the legendary, the mythic Kevin Ben Hooser.
The Who's.
Yep. The man. Love that. And so I did my dissertation on theological paradox, which was sort of an interdisciplinary PhD dealing with knowledge of God and divine mystery and language and all sorts of things. But as many people do, I also had other research interests at the same time. And I started working on this book while I was still in the PhD. And that's where everybody seemed to want to hear me talk was about Tolkien and Lovecraft and literature and that sort of stuff. So that's what I have continued on to do since graduation. And I've shifted over into theology and literature and theology and the arts more broadly. So I teach at Houston Christian University, no longer Houston Baptist University. I do a lot of the apologetics department, dealing with great texts and things like that.
Man, that's awesome. You piqued my interest with the paradox stuff. I mean, did you mess with like James Anderson stuff at all? Did you look into that? Okay. Did you, what can you give us like a summary? Like where do you come down? Like, do you think there is a paradox and we're justified in believing?
So I at the beginning, I articulate that I will adopt Anderson's definition of paradox as merely apparent contradiction. I actually just emailed him a week ago and JV Fesco, because there's a sort of a a bevy of approaches within the Vantillian sphere. I'm not a Vantillian, but it seems like that's all of the paradox people are talking. And some of the stuff that the Vantillians do, like Brant Bosserman, I was just very, very much against and like stridently against. And but Anderson's approach, I think, is a lot more healthy and actually retains the ability to, you know, support the laws of logic and things like that. So I came down on the fact that paradox is a result of passing over that creator-creature distinction, right? In theology, we're passing back and forth along this line that separates the creature and the creator. And so we have different forms of knowledge, and Tolkien will actually talk about this in some of his writings, is that English is one of the rare languages that doesn't have two different forms for knowing, separating between personal and factual knowledge. It used to, which is preserved in the English word wit. So if someone says to wit, or that somebody is witty, that is the leftover, the vestigial form of the English wissen from the, you know, the German wissen versus kennen.
Wow. Okay. Dude, I did not know that. Kennen is that like Wissenschaft too? Yeah. Like vision.
Okay. Yeah, so kennen becomes know, and wissen becomes wit, and then wit drops away. So one of the things I think English theology in particular gets into issues with is the failure to distinguish between knowing a person and knowing a fact.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. And so I say that in theology, it's presupposed that we can know God, and we know God through union with Christ and through the illumination of the Spirit. So we're united with God in one form of knowledge. But there's a whole different set of rules when we talk about articulating the things that we know when we know a person. And that's where the weird sort of paradox comes in.
Yeah, dang, that's so good. Yeah, like knowledge attribution. And I'm in an epistemology class right now, and this guy Matthew Benton, this philosopher, he makes this clear distinction, and he still motivates it through, he says, you know, we still do have these concepts of personal knowledge, interpersonal knowledge, knowledge of facts. They just come out. So he gives like different instances of sentences where that can be true. And it's funny because we have to do that. Like you said, we don't have the words for it anymore. So you have to look at different sentences and say like, well, look, he's saying he knows that, but you wouldn't say, I know that Parker. You'd say, I know Parker. Yeah. And so that's fun, man. That's so cool. You got to send me your dissertation. That'd be really fun.
I proposed to use the term familiarity instead of knowledge. Relational term. And it has the core of that family in there. We're part of God's economy, God's works. So that was my, little contribution to that, but I can send it to you if you want. But as I said, I haven't really touched it in about 5 years. I've been doing other stuff like writing this thing.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Well, I mean, do that, please. Let's jump in on this then. So, let me give you a really easy one. Was Tolkien a theologian?
Tolkien is a theologian in the sense that everybody is a theologian, and in the sense that everybody has a more or less ordered way of thinking about God. And Tolkien is more conscious of that than probably most people who are reading Lord of the Rings just for fictional fun time. He's a tier one intellectual at the premier university in the world, and at a time when scholarship is really still at the highest level. And so he, despite being an English professor and a professor of languages, was just very invested in his own faith and in making links between different elements of his life. And so he was engaged in very many theological conversations with other people who we would consider to be professional theologians, such as Austin Farrer or other priests and scholars at the Birmingham Oratory. The inklings we know from letters from Warney Lewis, C.S. Lewis's brother, a lot of times people would think that they were being quite rowdy, but really they're just debating theology. So we know that that's a constant sort of familiar element in Tolkien's conversations with C.S. Lewis and his other friends. So yes, I would say Tolkien is a theologian, but Tolkien would also very firmly say that he is a lay theologian and that he is not professionally trained. He's got that mastery of British understatement so that he always hedges when he talks about his theology, at least in public. But in his personal writings, he's very clear and direct about his theological opinions. So, for instance, he takes C.S. Lewis to task in private letters about certain theological positions that Lewis has taken in his writings. So, for instance, about divorce or remarriage, other things like that, the doctrine of prayer. So, yes, the long answer to the short question, was Tolkien a theologian? Yes, he was. But when we talk about analyzing Tolkien's theology, we have to do it a bit more indirectly than we would with somebody like Kevin Van Hooser, for instance, because Tolkien, it is said, he manifests all of the things that are most deeply felt to him in the form of story. And so this book looks at all of Tolkien's nonfiction writings, literally everything that he wrote. But then we also have to filter through and analyze the fictional stuff, the Middle Earth stuff as well, and see what truths we can draw from that fiction.
Yeah. So that brings me to that's super good, by the way. But this brings me to like the scope of the book and its intended use. Some people might be like, man, another book on Tolkien. And like, if you like Tolkien, you're probably not saying that, because it's like, bring on all the books. But like, yeah, what is the scope? What's the use of this book? And then how is it different than the ones we already have?
Of the making of Tolkien books, there can be no end, right? Are plenty of really good books on, for instance, spiritual themes in The Lord of the Rings, or, you know, reading Frodo's journey devotionally, things like this. There are even some scholarly studies on Tolkien's theology in Middle Earth. But there has not been at all any study of Tolkien as a theologian himself, right? So there has not been a study of Tolkien the man and the way that his thought hangs together systematically. So that's the big difference in this book, is I'm not restricting myself to just reading The Lord of the Rings or The Silmarillion and talking about the spiritual themes that he inserts there. I'm also reading his letters. I'm reading his Old English and Middle English criticism. I'm reading all of his other scholarly work. I'm reading the non-Middle Earth fiction, such as Leif by Niggle. And so taking every element of Tolkien's life, plus all of the secondary literature, all of the friends and family members that spoke about the things that he believed, I'm putting all of that together, not to focus on Middle Earth, but to focus on Tolkien as a man, as a scholar, as a thinker. And of course, Middle Earth plays a large part in that, but that is not the direct focus.
Yeah, I really like that. And you anticipated a lot of like pushback and questions. Like one question I had was like, I from what I had read of Tolkien, about Tolkien, he's like super staunch Roman Catholic, and you know, he was like, from what I hear, he was like mad at Lewis for being so public, since he wasn't a priest, you know, public apologist, stuff like that. So I thought, you know, whatever we need to know about Tolkien, we could just get from the catechism, you know, of the Roman Catholic Church. And you address that, then you're like, well, no, like there's still some room. Can you explain that? Like, why? How is it that we can still learn something from someone who just says, like, there's my theology right there in the catechism?
Well, I mean, every Roman Catholic theologian would say that, right? So every Roman Catholic theologian is under saving obedience to the church and is going to believe what the church believes. And that didn't stop Hans Urs von Balthasar from writing like a shelf worth of stuff.
Seriously.
Henri de Lubac from doing the same sort of thing. So insofar as there is a point in writing Catholic theology at all, there's a point in analyzing Tolkien and his own contributions. And I think what you mentioned is exactly another reason why it needs to be done, because even if you're coming at things from the Roman Catholic side, and I have many, many Roman Catholic friends who I've talked to this book about and sort of put it in front of them to say, is this an accurate portrayal of what it would have been like for him? Including, for instance, Carl Hofstadter, I'll name drop him. the recent editor of Nature of Middle Earth. So the fact that Tolkien did not go to seminary, he's sort of picking up his theology from his own reading, from the homilies that are being given to him at his parish church, that sort of thing. There are instances in which Tolkien would want to say, look, if I've written something that goes against the dogma, I need to be called out on that. And there are a few instances in the book where I sort of press him, not too many, but the idea is the fact that Tolkien is sort of eclectic in his theological reading makes for a subject worthy of analysis, not just saying, well, you know, here's the Catholic Catechism section 26 or whatever
you want to say. Yeah. That's so good. So, you touched on so many themes that I've been thinking about myself just over the years. My dad writes a lot of fiction himself, science fiction. And, you know, so from that my whole life, I've kind of been aware of like the hero with 10,000 faces type stuff and the story arc and how like, yeah, we watched Jackie Chan movie and my dad would be like, well, Jackie Chan's got to get beat up first. And then, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then growing up and seeing like there's no country for old men where like, spoiler alert, the bad guy wins. And thinking like, I kind of like that movie because I've seen the hero win so much. And my dad was like, no, that is not how you tell a good story. So just thinking of like the ethics of storytelling and whether or not a Christian, a Catholic can write a story that is based on a different world or and has like different motifs has always been kind of a question for me. And thinking of Tolkien writing to, I think it was I don't know how to say his name actually. I never said it out loud. Auden, the poet. It is Auden. Auden. Okay. He's writing to the poet, and I think he was like defending whether or not the orcs are like heretical for him to write about. Is that right? Did I read that right?
Yeah. So I can't remember if that's to W.H. Auden or not, but yes, that's one of the big quagmires that Tolkien sorts of writes himself into is the orcs as this sort of pure evil race. And he says this theologically, this is a problem, right? So if the orcs are evil as a race, that is, if they are born evil, that seems to be something beyond what Melkor or Sauron could do. That seems to be something that has to do with the very basic level of creation and being. And so he says, then how did the orcs come to be? Because with human beings, we know that it's actually God that curses them to be born into sin. So what do we do with the orcs? And the question of the orcs is a contested issue that changes a lot during Tolkien's lifetime. And I have a section in the book about Tolkien's changing views of the orcs and where they come from and how they fit into his doctrine of evil. But he basically says orcs are to be treated as we would any prisoner of war. They are to be given mercy if they ask for it, even if you know they're going to betray you. You give them basically, you know, human rights. There is no instance of an orc who is good in Tolkien's writing. I don't think that's a sort of a book that he was interested in. But if he would have lived longer, if he would have lived 10, 20 more years, he probably would have gotten around to it. We know those were the sorts of questions that he was dealing with towards the end of his life.
Does that have anything to do with like his like a privationist view of evil that like if something is, if something exists, it is in some degree good? Does it have to do with that?
Very much so, 100%. So I have another publication in the Journal of England Studies where Tom Shippey, who's sort of the doyen, the baron, the grandmaster of Tolkien studies, way, way back in The Road to Middle Earth and Author of the Century, he argues that Tolkien sort of has a tension between what he calls the Boethian or Augustinian view of evil as privation and then what he calls the Manichaean view of evil as a positive thing in itself. And he says that because Tolkien is trained as a medievalist and a Catholic, he wants to uphold this Augustinian view. And yet his experiences in World War I are pulling him towards the fact that evil is something that needs to be fought and not just pitied. Boethius, and I think it's book 3 of Consolation of Philosophy, said that ultimately evil is something that you should pity rather than feel anxious about. Augustine says that, by the way. So yes, he's very, very conscious of this heritage. I mean, King Alfred the Great, you know, of Anglo-Saxon glory and fame, wrote a commentary on Boethius which is actually more of a paraphrase, because we know by comparing the manuscripts that King Alfred actually inserts quite a lot of other material, commenting and expanding on Boethius, and particularly in these passages. So this tension that Shippey throws up or sort of inserts about Boethian versus Manichaean views of evil, even Shippey ultimately says Tolkien comes down on the Augustinian Boethian side, but it's been a huge distraction in terms of writing about Tolkien's theology of evil and writing about how Tolkien deals with evil. Everybody feels like they've got to address this issue. And in my article, I say that it's a false problem, and we need to start to broach new modes of reading Tolkien's writing about evil, because he's very clearly an Augustinian. I mean, he says it in so many words. He even has Frodo say it and Elrond say it, right? Nothing is evil in the beginning. Even Sauron was not so. He's very strongly in that camp.
Yeah. No, that's super huge. sorry, just sticking on that. Does the evil is to be pitied, does that come from like a Platonist understanding of evil being like ignorance?
Yes. Platonist or Neoplatonist. So when Boethius is talking about it, Lady Philosophy is sort of in his prison cell and telling him why it's not the case that evil just gets away with everything. That's one of Boethius's big complaints at the beginning, is that he's in this cell and all of the evil people are getting away with these false accusations, and how then is the world just? And she says, well, actually, good people are the only people that achieve their desires, because they achieve goodness, and goodness is happiness, and that's the thing that everybody wants. Wicked people, by definition, do not have goodness and therefore do not have happiness. And it's the most important thing to have, and they don't have it. What a bunch of pathetic losers they are. In fact, rather than being jealous of Theodoric or these other people that have put you in prison, Boethius, you need to, more than that, you need to pity them, because they're the ones that are losing out on the ultimate prize.
Yeah. That's tough when you're in it.
But Tolkien would have known that as well. I mean, pity, he'll capitalize it. Pity is one of his central themes. He defines pity more as Christian virtue of charity, of agape love, rather than pity of just sort of like looking down on somebody that's beneath you.
Yeah. Oh, man. Now, this is all sorts of implications for like loving your enemy and stuff, which is very Christian and very tough.
Yeah. Yep, there's a golem.
That's awesome. Yeah. Man. Okay. I picked up on this, like myth making as a clue to the true myth. And, I want to ask about that, because I think maybe, Lewis was a little bit louder with that, like myth became fact type stuff. But I think he got that from Tolkien.
Yes, he did.
Okay.
A lot of Lewis's trademark ideas he kind of snuck from Tolkien, by the way. So in Tolkien's poem Mythopoeia, which is one of my favorite poems of all time, it's the poem that he writes after the fact on the famous Addison's Walk between Hugo Dyson and C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, sort of bringing Lewis to the burgeoning conclusion that Christianity is the true myth. And so in that poem, Tolkien says this is the way that we ought to look at things, that God redeems the corrupt making creatures, human beings, right? We are intrinsically designed to be makers because we are in the image of the maker. He redeems the makers with a made thing, with a story. So that the idea of myth becoming fact is something that's central to Tolkien's understanding of the story of redemption. And yes, you are right. Lewis is borrowing that. We know Tolkien did it first, because Lewis wasn't even a Christian when Tolkien said it.
Yeah, it's so good. Yeah, is it Mythopoesis or Mythopoeia?
Mythopoeia is the name of the poem. Mythopoesis is the name of the activity. You can say
that. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great poem. I don't know. I think maybe Tim Keller would talk about it a lot. So I'm like, I need to go read this. And then I was like, wait a second, Tolkien's been saying this. And like, in the book, you talk about how Tolkien saw myth making as a clue towards like the true myth. Can you help us out? Like, how is myth making an evidence that there is a myth that is true, like the great true myth that became fact or whatever?
So I want to start a few steps back before I answer that question. We got to understand the context that Tolkien is writing out of. So he is going to school. He's being educated with the leftovers of the scholarship of Victorian England. You know, Tolkien is an Edwardian, but he's in the midst of the myth wars of all of these people who are taking part in this growing trend of anthropological cultural studies. You know, the Brothers Grimm, all of these people, they're finding these national epics, they're studying myth and the origins of myth. And so there are a lot of possible interpretations of what myth is. Is it the record of ancient rituals and sacrifices? Is it just a sort of a kernel of fact, which then gets blown up over time? Is it a way of talking about the seasons? There's all sorts of different theories that get propounded at this time. And one of them was that mythology is a disease of language. That is the phrase that gets used and that Tolkien combats in On Fairy Stories. And he says, no, far from being a disease of language, some sort of excrescence that language throws off as our words change. He says, mythology is at the heart of language. Like that is how language functions. And we see this get picked up in a much different way by somebody like, you know, Paul Ricoeur, who talks about the centrality of symbol and metaphor in our everyday speech.
You had to mention Ricoeur because he studied with Van Hooser.
Yep. Yeah. So when Tolkien starts to say that myth is a window into reality, he is reacting against a lot of people that want to sideline myth and say that it's not worth looking at, or if it's worth looking at, it's only worth looking at as a window into the human soul. And Tolkien says, no, myth is a window into something outside of ourselves. And he says the very fact that there's this huge concerted effort throughout all times and places and cultures to make these sorts of stories ought to indicate to us that it is a part of what it means to be human. And so for Tolkien, he says, even if Thor and Odin and all of these other myths were made up by people, the very fact that we give the thunderstorm this particular personality needs to be explained. And so he actually flips the table on people and says, this demands an answer. This demands an explanation somehow. And for him, it's in the image of God, that God has made us to be sub-creators. He has created us to rule over the world and to create stories in the way that God has created his story. And myth is the exemplar of that.
That's so good. So that's such a good segue into like subcreation. I love the language, by the way. And Tolkien messed with me so bad when I read. I don't know if it's Tree and Leaf or it's like a collection of his essays. And I learned about subcreation, and I was like, well, maybe we can create something whole cloth. And then like I couldn't do it. Maybe someone still can, but I can't. Like we still take pre-existing ideas, and I don't think we can ever make anything ex nihilo the way God did. But when it comes to our own mythopoesis, Mike, are there other ethics to it? Like,
yes.
There are. Like, I think of like DC
so
Comics.
So Tolkien will say,
I know that you love like nerdy stuff. I'm finding out that I'm like a nerd. Do you read DC at all?
Tolkien will say that there are limits to the author's imagination, but only in certain respects. So for one thing, the law of non-contradiction needs to be upheld. So your story needs to make sense. It needs to hold together. And then if you want to place the story within this world, as he does with Middle Earth, he says that Middle Earth is our world in a sort of fictionalized prehistoric past. And so if he's going to make that decision, then he's going to bind himself, you know, one reformed person might even say he's going to covenant himself to follow a certain set of rules. Like the origin of humanity, for instance, needs to be consonant with the biblical origin of humanity, because we know that's actually how it happened in this world. Right? Middle Earth may be a pre-Christian realm, but it's not a pre-creational realm, right? There's this time period between the creation of the universe and, you know, the call of Abraham. That's when all this stuff is taking place. And so if you're setting your story there, then you are binding yourself to follow the rules that are set out that kind of keep you in the framework of the biblical picture there. Tolkien's very influenced by other people that have come before him, like George MacDonald. and William Morris and John Ruskin and other English romantics. And they're basically going to say also that you can make the sun green, you can make grass blue, you can do whatever else. But the thing that doesn't change, whether in this world or in fairyland, is the moral law. The moral law always stays the same. So the instantiation of the moral law, right, that gap between principle and application is always what gets us into trouble in ethics, right? Everybody agrees about the principle. It's just, what do I do in this particular instance? That might have different implications in different worlds, but the moral law as such remains the same and it's universal because we are still sub-creators, and the moral law of God is part of God's essence. And so that's the same in every possible world. Creation, the laws of creation can change, but the moral law reflects the essence of God, and therefore in every possible world it is identical.
Nice. Okay. I think we were cut off here when I was asking the question earlier, but did you hear me ask about DC Comics
no,
at all?
But I want to.
Okay. I mean, I'm discovering that I'm like a huge nerd, and I didn't know this until like recently, but I love all sorts of nerdy stuff, but including DC Comics and Marvel Comics. And so like this whole year, I've just been like getting into it. Do you read DC at all?
Oh yeah. I got to give you a reading list. If we're going there, I got to give you a reading list to get caught up. Yes. I'm very much more in favor of DC. I do like Marvel, but I like DC more. And it's primarily for this reason, in that look at the history of comic books. DC or the brands that DC bought, they come first. They're older and they're closer to the genesis of the need for comic books, which is wishful. Comic books are the American mythology. And so all of the heroes that DC has in their sort of wheelhouse, they are these mythical figures. When Marvel comes around in the 60s, Marvel is doing something very different and they want to humanize their characters. They want to make their characters relevant and relatable. And so Marvel is the Bultmann of the comic world, and they're looking to demythologize some of these mythical figures. So that's why I like DC more, because I feel like that's what comics is for. You know, when you see Batman and Superman on the screen in a Zack Snyder movie, you don't have to have had like three or four setup movies in order to understand who they are. Like, we know who they are. They are Hercules. They are Achilles. They are Zeus. Like, their meaning is within themselves. We all know who these characters are. And you can just feel more free to play with them and to play with the ideas.
Yeah. Well, okay. So jumping in on that, I've been looking at like, DC's got this problem of rebooting and their crises events, and they keep having them over and over, and they keep, you know, retconning the origin of the universe. Is it, like, would Tolkien think that it's wrong for them to have like this great darkness and this great light, where it's like maybe Manichaean or something? Like,
yeah.
Could you tell us? He would say that you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, I think he would have a big problem with that. It would irritate me.
Okay.
I know it irritates me. In the rebooting, I think that he wouldn't necessarily say that it's immoral. I think he would say it's lazy storytelling, or that it's cheap. But what interests me about DC and Marvel and all of these reboots is that they're not actually reboots, right? Because within the universes themselves, within the fictional universes, these are different events that are happening. And you'll always have these holdover characters that remember the way that it was before. So in a sense, DC has never rebooted. They have never just like made a break and said, we're going to start over with new stuff. It's always an in-universe explanation for why things are now different, which is... a fascinating philosophical issue when you think about it. I mean, it makes me think of like Hud Hudson and Hypertime and that sort of stuff. But I don't think that he would find it a moral problem so much as a mechanical sort of storytelling problem.
Well, so what I'm thinking of is like, I think wherever Superboy Prime is from, that's our Earth.
Yeah.
And so,
it's
like,
not
our
anymore,
Earth,
right?
Isn't...
Because now it's separated from our Earth because we're making stories about it.
Yeah. But if you did want to be like self-referential in that, be like, okay, our Earth is included in the DC Omniverse, would Tolkien have a problem? Because then you're telling like a different creation story, and there's not just one. Oh, I guess it depends on if DC has a God above all, or the one above all that is God. But do you see where I'm getting at? Like, the ethics of the theology there?
They have the source. I actually have an essay on this.
Oh, nice.
So they have the source, and the source is supposed to be the Yahwistic God, which is why it's never necessarily in the stories, and it's never described so much. It's supposed to be this sort of an iconic figure to avoid.
It's not Jack Kirby.
Alienating. No, that's Marvel. Yeah, in Marvel, it's Jack Kirby.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think that for Tolkien, if we're setting it in this world, then it needs to be consonant with the biblical picture of the world in order to be correct. And I think DC has introduced enough aberrations from the biblical worldview to say that this is probably not a good idea. But I think Tolkien is also like a reasonable enough person to realize that not everybody is going to agree with the Christian picture of things, and that if you're Marv Wolfman or whoever that is writing these stories, then I mean, what else do we expect them to say?
Would he suggest like not reading it though?
No, I mean, Tolkien read all sorts of things. He read a lot of things that he disagreed with very much. Tolkien would not have adopted the pagan mythology of the Eddas, but we know that he read and enjoyed them very much. In his story of Kullervo, which is a precursor to the story of Turin Turambar, Kullervo is a hero from the Finnish Kalevala, and Tolkien sort of redid that bit of the story for himself. We find that he's actually theologically disgusted with some of the things that go on in that story. There's a sort of a shadowy typology of Mary that goes on in this story. And Tolkien says this is, you know, far below and degraded from what the real Mary ought to be. And yet he writes a whole book retelling the story. So, no, I think that Tolkien was very widely read. And we'll see, you know, in Holly Ordway's book, Tolkien's Modern Reading, she demonstrates there's a lot of things that Tolkien read that, even though he disagrees with it, he could still take enjoyment from it as a story. And for him, I think that's primary.
Okay. So when it comes to Middle Earth, and because it is a pre-incarnate, pre-redemption world like ours, or in place of a mythical, ours in mythology. Mm-hmm. There we go. Something like that. Eru Iluvatar, like, is that God? Like, is it relevantly similar? It is like to Yahweh.
Yeah, he's Yahweh.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's the narrative form that Yahweh takes. I mean, obviously, philosophically, he's not identical to Yahweh because Yahweh is real and this is a fictional story, but he is meant to be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, yes. He's not a stand-in or a stand-in dude. He's the same entity.
Gotcha. Okay. So what about the Trinity? Like, some theologians will look at Yahweh's use of "let us make man in our image," and they'll say like there's some room there for the Trinity. Others will say no, it's the royal we, and the Jews would have never interpreted it that way. Does Tolkien do anything like that with Iluvatar, hinting at like being able to be a Trinitarian
type guy? Yeah, yes, he does. So in the conversation Athrbeth Finrod Andreth, or in the English version, The Conversation of Finrod and Andreth, it's in one of the volumes of the History of Middle Earth, which is the posthumous manuscripts that Christopher Tolkien, his son, released. There is a conversation where Finrod talks about this. Finrod, by the way, if we've been watching Rings of Power, is Galadriel's brother that gets killed and that makes her so angry. The same guy. Also, the ring that Aragorn wears in Lord of the Rings, the sort of silver one with the green stone and the serpents, that's Finrod's ring that has been passed down through Aragorn's family.
Snap. Okay.
So this guy, Finrod, he's at the edges of a lot of different stories, but he's talking to this human woman, and in their conversation, mostly it's about the fall and mortality, but there Finrod says that if Morgoth is to be conquered, then Eru must come into Middle-earth himself in order to do it. Yet, in doing so, he would also remain as he is, who's the author outside of the story. And so in this case, we can sort of see there are distinctions. Tolkien says in his commentary on the story, there are distinctions within the one while he yet remains the one.
Nice.
The secret fire, which is in the Ainulindale at the beginning of the Silmarillion, there's a section in my book where I talk about whether the secret fire is to be the Holy Spirit or not. Most people will take it to be the Holy Spirit in some sense. The Son does not get talked about within the stories because it is not yet time for the Son to be revealed. So the fullness of time is not yet. But there are enough hints within Middle Earth that, yes, Eru is Trinitarian, or at least there are mysteries to Eru's being that not everybody knows about yet.
Yeah, that's so good. okay, so here's one that I actually don't know which came first. It was probably Tolkien's, but Lewis and Tolkien both, in depicting the creation of their fictional worlds, depict the world being sung into existence. Do you know if, was that Tolkien's first?
Tolkien wrote Einar Lindale in 1917, 1918. So he's writing that as he's in the trenches, some of it, and then while he's convalescing after getting trench fever and getting pulled back. And then obviously Narnia doesn't come out until the 40s, 50s. Quite a lot longer before Lewis is doing it. I told you. so they're both talking about singing. Yeah. So the singing element is, yes, Tolkien did it first, but it is, I would say, a bit of creative license on his part in order to illustrate some of the principles. We know music was very important to him. We know music was particularly very important to his wife, Edith, who would have been the primary audience at the time. They had just been married. So the concept of harmony and dissonance and all of that sort of thing, I think there's reasons for that. Sounds pretty too. If you're going to involve the angels in creation, then you have to give them something to do. And so rather than just have God speak it and it be this sort of monologic activity, if you're going to have the angels participate as sub-creators, then they have to have roles, obviously. And I think putting them into a choir or a symphony is one easy way to do that.
Yeah. I asked Chris Wiley, C.R. Wiley, about this, and he brought up the Music Man and was like, hey, singing is just sustained talking. And I thought that was pretty funny. And he was saying, like, it doesn't have to be just one or the other kind of thing. Like, what do you make of that? Like, could God have created through singing? Could, you know, in the beginning, God said, let there be light. Could there have been, like, some resonance or, like, harmonics?
Well, I mean, everything we know says that our speech about God is analogical, right? There are similarities and there are differences. We know that God accommodates himself to human modes of speech, right? God doesn't have vocal cords, at least not outside of his human nature in Christ. And so whatever we say in Genesis 1, we have to interpret somewhat loosely because of the nature of what we're dealing with. Depending on who you side with and how poetically you want to read Genesis 1 through 3, you know, what is the difference between poetry and song, really? I guess I would say always possible. Now, this is one of those areas, actually, where Tolkien sort of departs from the Catholic tradition. So for Aquinas, for instance, Aquinas specifically denies a role to angels in creation. He said angels did not do anything, whereas for Tolkien, they sort of fill out quite a lot. So he takes a little bit of independence in this story in particular. What's interesting is this is one of the first things he writes in Middle Earth, and it's also basically unchanged until his death. So he writes this story. He tinkers with so much and so much else of his writing, but this particular story kind of stays stable through his entire life, more or less.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I like that in the book. You showed, or you talked about a lot of the things that have changed. But yeah, that's so fascinating that this one didn't change. So I wonder, like, this is taking place in Middle Earth. Middle Earth is like a mythical depiction of Earth prior to the incarnation. So, like, I wonder how he's okay with saying that, like, angels participated in creation. What do you make of that?
Well, in my chapter on angels in the book, before I get too far into it, I realized that I got to speak to my audience and assuage their difficulties. So I do a little bit of biblical theology at the beginning of the chapter. And I say that actually Tolkien's version of angels is a lot closer to the Old Testament context than our modern sort of 21st century Protestant view of angels, which has them really not doing much of anything. I mean, God asked Job, where were you when the morning stars sang together at creation, right? Yeah. We know stars means angels in sort of biblical symbolism. They're singing together at the beginning of creation and praising God for the thing that he has laid out. There are many instances of angels being said to be present at the dawn of time. We know that angels are his ministers and his servants and his messengers. And so I think Tolkien has enough leeway in the text to say that angels could have participated in the shaping of the cosmos, right? That he says the Valar are most active in the sort of cosmic timescales. Before the planet gets formed, they're the ones that are sort of spreading out the nebulae and lighting the stars, and they're there, you know, moving the tectonic plates so that the Earth gets shaped correctly. So the fact that God alone is the source of being, Tolkien says that very explicitly. Like Morgoth goes looking for things that he can make on his own. It says he was looking for the secret fire, but he found it not, for it is with Iluvatar. God alone is the one that actually gives life and existence. And so the angels are actually just shaping pre-existing things in accordance with God's plan for them. So God says, this is what I want. This is the music that I want you to perform. And within that, you are free to make your own interpretations of that. I mean, if you think about music, there might be one Rachmaninoff piece and three different piano players will play the same piece and you'll get a different result based on that person's personality, right? So they're following the same notes, but their personality is expressed in that. And I think that's what Tolkien is doing with the angels. God gives them the sheet music to play and they follow his commands after he's given it being. But it says each of them is able to recognize their own handiwork. So I think that he gives the creation proper still fully over to God, and the angels remain the ministers. So I think he stays within the bounds of orthodoxy there.
Okay. How about, I believe it was Melkor who was singing like discordant, you know, music into the initial music. And then Eru is like, even that was according to my plan. I mean, what do you make of that with like the devil and or Satan and also does Tolkien give an initial explanation for Melkor's fall?
He does not.
Okay.
Bible, we might note. So he says that Melkor has started becoming a little weird because he goes often alone into the void looking for the secret fire. That's not necessarily said to be a sin yet, but we do know that he is isolating himself from the rest of the angelic community, and that he is maybe considering breaking away, depending on your doctrine of the will. Is that a sin or not if your will hasn't fully ascended to it? Like, he leaves that open. He says, like, this is as close as we can come to sort of figuring out why he did this and the other angels didn't. But yeah, the other issue is that God is working all of that into his plan. And he says, actually, the worst things that Melkor has done actually end up turning into or coming out of that as some of the best things. And I think that's just such a powerful passage in the Silmarillion, where he talks about how God's subverting all of the devil's designs. I mean, speaking of Tim Keller earlier, I heard him preach at one point in Memphis, and the line always stuck with me as he said, how many people lost their faith there at the foot of the cross, where the greatest thing that God ever did for humanity was happening in front of them.
Right.
So the idea of providence is a big one for Tolkien, and you sort of have to stitch it together from several different areas. But the idea of how much God knows of the future and how much God is in control of it is not one that Tolkien ever explicitly says, other than like the very high level, everything is under the hand of God and everything will work out according to God's design. But like mechanically, granularly, how much control he has, that's a topic of discussion in an extended passage in the book where I try to harmonize those things.
Yeah.
And I think honestly, at some points, Tolkien almost sounds like a Molinist, but I doubt that he would have been familiar with Molinism based on his reading and his interests. And some places he sounds very much like a Calvinist, or, you know, really a Thomist, because that's, you know, basically the same thing on this score. And then in other places, he's very much in line with traditional Catholic doctrine, which emphasizes the freedom of the will of human creatures. So in the book, I try to do some work to sort of tease these out, rather than, I think, what a lot of people would say, oh, he just contradicts himself on providence. I think, well, maybe there's more to be said there. But it is, yeah, that's a complex issue in his thought.
Well, when it, I know some people will think, we'll talk about Lord of the Rings and be like, look, this is like deism. You know, you don't see like specific instances of Eru Iluvatar like interceding or intervening or anything like that. What do you make of that charge? Like, is Tolkien's god a deistic god?
Absolutely not. I think if you read The Lord of the Rings carefully, even within The Lord of the Rings, which is considered, you know, the most godless of Tolkien's book, it's very clear that God is doing things. For instance, the Council of Elrond is never called. They all just show up for their own reasons at the same time and in the same place. And they're like, hey, we ought to do something about this ring. Just there. Gandalf will say very specifically, there was a power at work, and it was not the power of the enemy. Now, some people can say this is the Valar doing things, but from what we know about the Valar and other writings, they are always doing things under the authority of and with the permission of God himself. So it's, you know, six or half dozen on that score.
Yeah.
It's the Valar or God himself directly. There's plenty of instances even within The Lord of the Rings where providence is active. Even in the climax, right? So the fact that Gollum is still there to bite off Frodo's finger and fall into the lava is a result of a lot of prior decisions being made by human beings, including Frodo and Sam and Gandalf and Thranduil and Aragorn and all of these people who are agents of providence that are sometimes inspired directly by God with new thoughts, like we see Sam many times being inspired to say something, or an instance where Frodo would say, it seemed like somebody else was speaking out of his mouth. There's all sorts of stuff thrown into Lord of the Rings. And when you expand it outside of Lord of the Rings, it becomes even more clear. So in the Silmarillion that we're talking about, God says that he has not showed the end of the story to anybody, that he retains the right to intervene at any point that he wants and does. The fall of Numenor, right? Now more people know what Numenor is now that Rings of Power has come out, right? When the Numenor collapses into the earth, that is a direct act of God. The Valar do not have the authority to change the shape of the world. So they actually lay down their power, and God does that himself. But especially at the level of providence, God is doing things all the time. But even above that, actual direct miraculous action, God is also doing that in several instances in The Lord of the Rings. And so in the chapter on revelation that I have in the book, I go through all of these miraculous forms of revelation, dreams and prophecies and visions and all sorts of things that are coming from the powers above. There is really very little justification. I mean, Lord of the Rings came out in 1973. Maybe for somebody that had not been reading terribly closely, we could say that God is a deist, but goodness gracious, it's been 50 years since then. There's no reason to make that argument anymore. It's untenable. Yeah.
So awesome. I love that. I got two more for you. So you mentioned in the book about foreknowledge, you know, and omniscience and how it is that the God of Middle Earth knows things, and, you know, whether it's like from the completed story or what have you. And it has to do with like the creation as well, that it seems like the creator didn't just create time and space, but also, you know, that's just like the furniture of the story, but also the plot. Can you flesh that out for us more? Like, how did that represent Tolkien's view of foreknowledge and omniscience as well?
So I think the only window that we have into Tolkien's views on this really in an extended way are in one of his sort of pseudo-historical texts, right? Like the appendices, like where he sort of keeps maintaining this illusion that these are documents that he found. And he says, well, this is what the elves think. And then he'll say a bunch of philosophy. So one of the things, the most important document that we have is a document called Fate and Free Will, which Carl Hostetter published many years ago in the Tolkien Studies Journal. And that's also in the Nature of Middle Earth book that just came out that he edits. This is where a lot of that stuff comes from. And it's couched very significantly as a bit of elvish philosophy, which we know is not necessarily one-to-one with what does Tolkien himself think about the real world. So that's right. The caveat that we have to start with at the beginning. And I note that in the book, that there are these danger points where we can go too glibly from one to the other.
Yeah.
In that document, it seems as if Eru's foreknowledge is limited by the free will of his creatures.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that we necessarily have to go that entire way. And I think in all of the writings that we have on providence in Middle-earth in particular, it's couched in this sort of conscious fact that this is a story that Tolkien is writing. And so the idea of narrative and of narrativity is important in all of Tolkien's Middle-earth stuff, because that's very close to the heart of what he's doing. It's this doctrine of subcreation and when it is valid and when it's not valid. So outside of that, how important is narrative to Tolkien's idea of providence? We don't know. We only know what's been published. But based on what's been published, I think it's incredibly important. And in fact, it's inspired a lot of my own work outside of this book. I'm trying to tease out this idea of God as author, God as author of the plot. I have another essay that was published in Zygon, in the science and theology journal Zygon, about Tolkien and the plot of evolution. He talks a bit about evolution and the narrative of history. So think about all the questions that this raises. I mean, think about if we talk about God as author standing outside the text, think about what that would mean for how we articulate a doctrine of omniscience and omnipresence. You know, how is God present in his story? Well, in the same way that Tolkien is present in his story. He's doing everything, but his name never shows up on the cover page. Frodo decides that he's going to take the ring to Mordor. Why does he decide it? Based on the character and the previous decisions that he has laid out in his life. Nobody is forcing him to do it. It's a freely undertaken quest. And yet, Tolkien is also doing that on a separate level of being. So the idea of authorship, I think, is a huge lever into moving some of these big theological concepts like divine presence, divine hiddenness, divine action, even theodicy. Tolkien will talk about theodicy in this respect. Like Frodo and Sam have this famous talk about looking back on it, it will seem very different. And people will want to hear this story of Frodo and the Nine Fingers of the Ring of Doom, even though Frodo and Sam would rather be anywhere else. So if we think about creation as having a plot, for instance, we can think about the creation having a conflict. If Lord of the Rings didn't have a conflict, we wouldn't be reading Lord of the Rings. It would not have the beauty of the story that it does. If creation did not have an antagonist to its plot, namely the devil, then a lot of the conflict could not move forward. So there are all sorts of fascinating issues that arise when we talk about God as the author and human beings as sub-creators. And I think Tolkien puts his finger on something that for our post-Platonist world that has denied this sort of chain of being really helps us to understand all of these doctrines that for a lot of the church fathers and even the medievals, it was a sort of a sine qua non, like it's taken for granted the way that they understand this stuff.
Yeah, man. You hit on so many things that I love. I wrote my master's thesis at TEDS under Van Hoos, and I wanted to write on his particular view of the authorial analogy, and I wanted to write about God and time. And he's like, well, dude, they're going to ask you about evil, and you know, like, what the heck? If God's the author of evil, that's a big problem. So then he made me write on evil, and it was awesome, dude. It's so helpful to think through the authorial analogy, and even thinking through like, hey, look, God made a good story. It would be a worse story without the devil because we wouldn't have redemption, and we wouldn't see God as long suffering and as loving his enemies and patient, and all these other, all the different attributes of God that we see through like the prism of this story. We wouldn't know God as well if he had not allowed Satan to fall and all that
and
stuff.
And think about this as well. If we understand God to be the author outside the text, it's on a different level of being than his characters. I mean, think about some of the stuff that happens in the Silmarillion, right? The dragons get released and there's these hills of corpses of elves that have been tortured and slaughtered. But Tolkien's not morally wicked for writing that.
Right.
Right. So Morgoth is morally wicked for doing that within the story, but the author outside of the story isn't really morally blameworthy for allowing that or writing that to happen. Now, I can think of stories where authors are morally wicked, and that does manifest in the sort of things that they have happen in their stories. You know, certain scenes I can think of very easily would demonstrate a sort of depravity in the mind of the author, but it's not a necessary implication. And so when we think about God allowing evil, even sometimes very actively, like he does with Job, God's moral status, because he is of a higher level of being than human creatures, doesn't seem to be affected in the way that it does for creatures that are on the same level of being.
Yeah. Yeah. James Anderson has a great essay in Calvinism and the Problem of Evil using this. And I think he even talks about Tolkien. It's super helpful for thinking like, hey, look, how crazy would it be to go and try and arrest Tolkien for the murder of Deagle by Smeagol? Like, how dare you do that? And it's like, no, it's a different level of being. It doesn't really make sense. I could also imagine someone saying, well, if you can imagine someone being like culpable for writing a bad plot here in this level of reality, then God, you know, superintended that whole thing. So then it passes on to God. And it's like, well, this is where I think skeptical theism comes in and go, look, you'd have to be God in order to know the full plot and be able to say that God doesn't have a morally sufficient reason for allowing that evil that we experience. We've seen that he has taken the worst evil at the cross and brought about the greatest good. So we're justified in believing that he could do that with any lesser evil that we experience. And we have to be God to know that the plot doesn't include a greater good. So I love it, man.
Now we get into the question of nested fictions, right? So So Frodo is writing stories inside the Lord of the Rings. What level of reality do those things have? Anyway, there's a lot to be said about
that. Yeah, yeah. That's so super awesome. well, dude, this has been huge. The book is Tolkien Dogmatics, Theology Through Mythology with the Maker of Middle Earth. There's a lot of good theology that you will learn by reading this book. So I'm really excited about that. And you'll get a ton, like even just the notes are huge. Like
yeah,
if you read through the notes,
leave out the footnotes. There's a lot of really good stuff in the footnotes, y'all. End notes. Whatever.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I have to forgive you that they're end notes and not footnotes,
I think the fact is,
that's awesome.
So I'll give a plug for Lexham here. So, Lexham publishes an ebook. They also have it as a Logos Bible software resource. And I think there's just, Endnotes, I know for me, like when I'm reading digitally, endnotes is a lot easier to go through when I'm doing digital resources than having footnotes at the bottom of the page that then have to be navigated. But yes, a lot of good stuff in the footnotes, including a lot of somewhat important stuff that isn't directly related to Tolkien and theology. But yeah, that one of the reasons I wrote the book is halfway to defend Tolkien from these charges of people that try to say that Tolkien's Christianity is not an important element in his life, partly so that it can be a sort of one-stop shop for people to do their own further research, because I mean, it's pretty exhaustive. Like all of the stuff that I reference in there, that's it. You can go and you can read it yourself and do your own research from there. Use it as a classroom text. But part of it is it's a systematic theology, right? It goes through most of the points.
Yeah.
And if this is your avenue into reading a systematic theology for the first time, then that's something that the book can do for you as well.
Yeah. Man, I love that. I love the idea of luring people into philosophy and theology through popular works like this. And I caught that as I'm reading it. I'm like, dude, he's doing it. He's doing what I want to do. That's so good. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Well, cool.
Well, Austin, yeah, sorry, man. I think my internet is being stupid right now, but, if people wanted to, so go and grab the book, folks. You can find that, I'll put an affiliate link in the description, or just go to Amazon and find it at Tolkien Dogmatics. If someone wanted to get more of your thoughts, where can they find you at?
So my writings are published, in various different venues. I have a book on H.P. Lovecraft and theology, which my chapter in that book that I edited also includes some thoughts on Tolkien. That's available from Lexington Press. And then I have a few other articles on Tolkien that have appeared in other scholarly journals from Walking Tree Press and other things. I think it's all available on Google Scholar, or at least the citations are. I am not on Twitter yet, but coming back from ETS, everybody's sort of telling me that I kind of need to be on Twitter now. So maybe in the future, we shall see. But so far, I'm trying to let the work speak for itself at this point.
Yeah, that's awesome. I highly recommend it, folks. Go and grab that book. This has been Parker's Pensies, and as always, all glory to God.